Now, an animated logo appears of a towering block of gold letters, 20th Century Fox. Spotlights on either side of the logo point skyward and wave back and forth, crisscrossing their shining beams. Small words appear at the bottom, a News Corporation company. Now, on a black screen, wavy light blue shapes snake across our view. The odd shapes are glimmers on the surface of syrupy black liquid. Titles appear. 20th Century Fox presents a 1013 production. More syrupy forms become a letter X, enclosed in a crescent shape. Words appear on either side of the letter, completing a title, The X-Files. Now, a bleak grayness fills our view. A horizontal line becomes visible, then two minuscule figures running side by side. They grow in size as they hustle toward us. Shaggy, poncho-like animal skins hang from their trudging bodies. Words type out on screen, North Texas, 35,000 BC. Now we see a long three-toed footprint in the snow. The two figures run past it. Their heavy animal skin boots follow a trail of three-toed footprints. Now, against the whiteness, falling snowflakes drop at the dark mouth of a cave. The footprints lead into it. Inside the dark passage, daylight streams in. Milky blue walls of ice resemble choppy water frozen in time. The travelers enter. They step farther from the light. Icy patches overhead glow a deep blue. One traveler strikes a flint. Torch flames illuminate one of the hunched over travelers. His long hair hangs flat on either side of his blunt-featured face. Both men carry torches farther inside. Misty breath puffs from their mouths, and the yellow fire from their torches gleams in a patch of black ice on the floor. The two primitive men split up. The younger holds his torch out before him and quickly looks to his left. In the black void, a glowing blue passageway looks like a staring eye. The younger primitive passes through it. In one hand, he holds a dagger made of bone. Gripping the torch in his other hand, he disappears down the tunnel. Icy mist trails in his wake. Now the flickering torchlight brightens a passageway as the primitive steps from it. His ape-like face glows softly in the light of the yellow flames. The man finds himself in a grotto full of rock stalagmites. His gaze roves to a bulging slab of ice. Frozen in the glassy layers, a man's face stares blankly at him. A demonic being throws the man back. It claws into the man's chest. The man plunges his dagger into its side and they wrestle. As the creature chomps the man's neck, the older man arrives and stabs the beast in the back. He gets thrown off by the monster and lands face down in the snow. He regains his senses and jumps to his feet. The beast is gone. The elder man spots a dim gap in the grotto wall. At his feet, the dead man's dagger lies covered with black blood. His neck is shredded open. The sound draws his attention back to the slender gap. Holding his dagger ready, he passes through it to a cavern of rough brown rock. The light from his torch dances on the walls, revealing two darkened hollows in the rock wall. The man eyes them warily. A moist sheen a few feet away captures his attention. Investigating, he finds the creature lying motionless on the ground. Nearly twice his size, it has a fleshy, noseless head, shaped like an elongated egg, and two large black eyes. As he waves his torch, it blinks its murky eyelid. It springs up. The creature attacks, and the two fall over. The man straddles the beast and stabs it repeatedly. The creature's arms fall limply to the ground. As the man studies it, syrupy black blood flows from its stab wounds. A puddle spreads across the sandy ground. Tiny dimples form on the puddle's surface, and the liquid flexes like muscle. It changes direction and seeps toward the man. He leans back in amazement, then finds the blood wriggling up his chest. Panting, his eyes widen, and he begins to convulse. Now, a boy in a t-shirt and shorts drops through the ceiling. Three other boys gape from above.
Hey, Stevie, you okay?
Sunlight shines down on the boy in the pit. He stands.
I got the wind knocked out of me.
Looks like a cave or something.
Around 11 years old, the boy grins at his dark surroundings, a cavern of rough brown rock. Spitting, he steps into the shadows.
Stevie? What's going on?
Above ground, his friends stare into the pit. Stevie reappears, holding something.
It's a human skull!
Toss it up here, dude!
No way, but wipe, it's mine. Anyway, there's bones all over the place, man.
Stevie turns the skull in his dusty hands. He finds a jagged 4-inch hole in the back, then abruptly looks down at his feet. A puddle of the morphing black blood spreads out under his sneaker.
What the?
He glances nervously up at his friends. The skull drops to the ground. At Stevie's feet, the blood separates into tiny leech-like strips. By the dozens, the strips travel up his sneakers and worm under his skin. The tiny bulges slide up his legs, arms, and neck. Stevie's eyes widen.
Stevie?
Hey, Stevie!
You okay?
The organisms blacken his eyeballs.
Hey, man. Let's get out of here.
Stevie looks up from the pit and blinks. The three boys above ground run away. They hurry toward a suburban neighborhood surrounded by flat, dusty terrain. Words type out on screen, North Texas, present day. Now, the light of midday fades to late afternoon. Fire trucks pull to a halt near the pit. A man with a badge and a two-way radio jogs to the edge of it. Several others in coveralls and helmets follow.
Give me a 14-footer!
They run a ladder down it.
Captain Miles Coolis, got a rescue situation in progress. I'll be the Old Town Road IC. Rope's in the hole, let's go. Two down.
Two men climb down into the pit. Clipped to safety ropes, they find Stevie lying in the shadows.
What you got, TC? Talk to me.
The captain radios from above.
Do you see the boy? Talk to me.
In the pit, the jostling safety ropes trail off into the darkness.
Come back, TC. You see the kid? Danny, check TC's radio. TC?
Glenn, Sal, in the hole.
Later, a black helicopter lands at the site. The captain and two firemen watch as five white-clad technicians climb off. Filtration packs on their belts connect to clear visored hoods that cover their heads. They carry over a long, airtight case with a plexiglass lid. It resembles a casket. Now, a middle-aged man in a tie steps from the chopper. He squints under his bushy eyebrows at a group of onlookers. The middle-aged man and the fire captain stride toward the pit.
Sent four men down there for the boy. The point is, his eyes have turned black. Now we lost communication with my men.
They stop as the white-clad technicians haul the airtight case to the chopper. Stevie lies inside it, his black eyes gazing skyward. The middle-aged man watches gravely. The fire captain turns to him. The technicians load the body case onto the chopper.
What about my man?
and middle-aged man stares at him. Now the chopper lifts off and white tractor trailers arrive. Several tanker trucks circle the area.
What the hell is this?
A tanker rolls past the townspeople, and a sheriff steps back as a flatbed pulls in front of the fire trucks. Heavy tarps cover its bulky cargo. The middle-aged man walks briskly as more trucks arrive. He marches by the tall grill of a semi. Stepping behind the cab, he dials a cell phone.
It's Braunschweig. Sir, the impossible scenario that we never planned for? Well, we better come up with a plan.
Now a helicopter darts from behind a building. Banking in a wide arc over the city, it approaches a large skyscraper of black-tinted glass. Words type out on screen. Federal Building, Dallas, Texas, 1 week later. A dozen men crouch on the roof as the helicopter lands. A fit, balding man with a mustache gets out. He wears a dark jacket with the FBI acronym printed on the chest, sleeves, and back. A younger man in a similar jacket meets him.
We've evacuated the building and been through it bottom to top. There's no trace of an explosive device or anything resembling one.
Have you sent the dogs through yet?
Yes, sir.
We'll send them through again.
As the mustached man swaggers off, the young agent faces his crew.
All right, guys. Do it again.
The mustached agent steps toward the building's edge. He spies a lone figure pacing the roof of a neighboring office tower. As a helicopter passes, our view cranes around to the mustached agent's profile. His jaw stiffens, and his unblinking eye remains fixed on the distant stranger. Now, atop the office tower, a red-headed female agent in her 30s uses a cell phone.
Mulder, it's me.
Where are you, Scully?
I'm on the roof.
Did you find anything?
No, I haven't.
What's wrong?
Well, I just climbed up 12 floors. I'm hot, I'm thirsty, and to be honest, I'm wondering what I'm doing up here.
You're looking for a bomb.
Yes, I know that. But the threat was called into the federal building across the street.
I think they have that covered.
Mulder, when a terrorist bomb threat is called in, the rational purpose of providing that information is to allow us to find the bomb. The rational object of terrorism is to promote terror. If you study the statistics, you find a model behavioral pattern for virtually every case where a threat has turned up an explosive device. And if we don't act in accordance with that data, if you ignore it as we have done, the chances are great that if there actually is a bomb, we might not find it. Lives could be lost. Mulder. Mulder.
Oh,
he's behind her.
Jesus, Mulder.
Whatever happened to playing a hunch, Scully?
The element of surprise, random acts of unpredictability. If we fail to anticipate the unforeseen or expect the unexpected in a universe of infinite possibilities, we may find ourselves at the mercy of anyone or anything that cannot be programmed, categorized, or easily referenced.
Mulder nibbles sunflower seeds.
What are we doing up here, Scully? It's hotter than hell.
In his 30s, Mulder gazes at her from under his dark, short-cropped hair.
I know you're bored in this assignment, Mulder, but unconventional thinking is only going to get you into trouble now.
What makes you think I'm bored?
You got to quit looking for what isn't there. They've closed the X-Files. There's procedure to be followed now, protocol.
Maybe we should call in a bomb threat to Houston. I think it's free beer night at the Astrodome.
Her light blue eyes stare at him. She reaches for the door.
Oh. Now what?
It's locked.
So much for anticipating the unforeseen.
As Mulder opens the door, Scully smiles.
I had you.
No, you didn't.
Oh, yeah. I had you big time.
You had nothing. Come on, I saw you jiggle the handle.
Now, down in the lobby.
I saw your face, Mulder. There was a definite moment of panic.
Hey, you've never seen me panic. When I panic, I make this face.
A dull stare.
That was the face.
You didn't see that face.
I saw that face. You're buying.
Come on. Coke, Pepsi, saline IV?
Something sweet.
School children on a field trip board an elevator. As Scully waits by the security desk, Mulder heads down a corridor. He turns a corner and a workman steps from a door ahead. Mulder brushes past him and goes in. In the room, vending machines line the wall. Mulder inserts a few coins into one labeled cold drinks. He pushes a button on the selection panel. Eyeing the unresponsive machine, he tries all the buttons. When the coin return yields nothing, he gives the machine a whack. Mulder purses his lips and rocks the machine. Stepping back, he shoots an exasperated gaze at it. He peers in the narrow space between the vending machine and another beside it, then sidles in toward the back wall. Mulder's gaze roves to the floor, where he finds a pulled plug. He picks it up. His gaze cranes up to the unplugged machine. He goes to the door. He tugs on the knob. The door is jammed. Mulder dials on his cell phone. The LCD displays Scully's name and number. Back in the lobby.
Scully.
Scully, I found the bomb.
You're funny. Where are you, Mulder?
I'm in the vending room.
As he whacks on the door, Scully enters the corridor.
Is that you pounding?
Yeah, you gotta get somebody to open that door.
Scully tries the knob.
Nice try, Mulder.
Look, Scully, it's in the soda machine.
You got about 14 minutes to evacuate this building.
Come on, Mulder.
56. 1354.
He paces before the machine, its front panel now opened. It's full of explosives. 1350.
You see a pattern emerging here, Scully?
Inside the machine, liquid-filled canisters sit taped together on a shelf. Scully finds the door's keyhole filled.
Hold on, Mulder. I'm going to get you out of there.
Mulder stares tensely at the bomb. Now in the lobby.
We need this building evacuated and cleared out in 10 minutes. I want you to call the fire department and have them block off the city center at a 1 mile radius around the building.
10 minutes?
Don't think. Just pick up that phone and make it happen.
Scully uses her cell phone.
This is security. Emergency in progress.
This is Special Agent Dana Scully. I need to speak with SAC Michaud. He's got the wrong building.
Later, police cars and fire trucks race to the office tower. The mustached agent, Michaud, gets out of his car and strides toward the building. As other FBI agents hurry inside, he approaches Scully.
Where is
he? He found it in the vending machine. He's locked in with it.
Back at the vending machine, plastic explosives line the beverage chutes. Wires lead to a numeric display, which shows less than 5 minutes left. Sweat gleams on Mulder's face. Startled, he answers his cell phone.
Scully, you know that face I just showed you? I'm making it again.
Mulder, move away from the door. We're coming through it.
Sparks burst from the top seam of the door. Out in the hall, Michaud wears tinted goggles as he cuts through with a glass plasma torch. He cuts a large slab out of the door.
Clear!
Agents kick it in. Mulder glances at Michaud.
Tell me, that's just soda pop in those canisters.
Michaud studies the bomb. White light from the drink machine washes across his face and shines in his eyes.
It's just what it looks like. Big IED. 10 gallons of astrolite. Okay. Get everybody out of here. Clear the area.
Come on, let's go.
Somebody's got to stay here with you.
I just gave you an order. Now get the hell out of here and evacuate the building.
Can you defuse it?
Yes, I can.
We got less than 4 minutes to find out if you're right.
Did you hear what I said? Get out.
Face to face, their gazes lock.
Come on, Mulder.
Mulder reluctantly follows Scully. Left alone, Michaud scrutinizes the bomb. Outside, more emergency vehicles arrive. Police officers direct evacuees away from the building. The school children file toward their bus. Now, the bomb's numeric display counts down. 42, 41, 40. Michaud sits still on his tool case. His hands are folded, and he gazes serenely at the bomb. Now, Scully and Mulder race from the building. Mulder stops.
Mulder, what are you doing?
Scully grabs him.
Something's not right.
Well, then get in the car. There's no time!
Go, get in the car!
A waiting officer pounds the roof of his cruiser, and Mulder and Scully go. Now, as the bomb counter nears 10 seconds, Michonne bows his head. Outside, Scully and Mulder hop in the car. As they pull away, the bomb counter reaches zero. A wall of fire engulfs Michonne. The blast erupts from the lobby and throws the rear of Mulder and Scully's moving car into the air. Glass rains down as they slam into a parked car. The fiery explosion swells upward and consumes the building's floors, which drop like playing cards. Smoke rises from the gaping cavity left behind. One-fourth of the building is gone. Mulder and Scully get out of the cruiser. Fragments of glass lie scattered across its trunk. Squinting through the smoky haze, the agents take in the now visible damage. A mangled cross-section looms over them. Ragged pieces of cement and drywall hang from the building's gutted floors. Papers waft downward, and sparks flash in darkened rooms.
Next time you're buying.
In the dusty afternoon light, Mulder ambles off. Scully puts her hands on her hips and lets out a fatigued breath. Now, words type on screen, FBI headquarters, Washington, D.C., Office of Professional Review.
In light of Waco and Ruby Ridge, there's a heightened need at the Attorney General's office to place responsibility as early as possible for the catastrophic destruction of public property and loss of life due to terrorist activities. Many details are still unclear, but we're under some pressure from the Attorney General to give an accurate picture of what happened so that she can issue a public statement. We know now that five people died in the explosion.
Mulder enters and joins Scully at a table facing a committee and a chairwoman.
Special agent in charge, Darius Michonne, who was trying to defuse the bomb, three firemen from Dallas and a young boy. I'd like to begin this interview.
Excuse me, the firemen and the young boy, they were found in the building?
Agent Mulder, since you weren't able to be on time for this hearing, I'd like you to step outside so that we can hear Agent Scully's version of the facts, so that she will not be paid the same disrespect.
We had been told the building was clear.
You'll get your turn, Agent Mulder. Please step outside.
Mulder nods. He notices his and Scully's supervisor, Agent Skinner, seated with the committee. Skinner stares at Mulder and motions to the door with a shake of his head. Later in the hall, Mulder sits, leaning on his knees. He nibbles sunflower seeds. The hearing room door opens.
Sit down, they're still talking to Agent Scully.
Skinner.
About what? They're asking her for a narrative. They want to know why she was in the wrong building.
She was with me.
Skinner squarely faces Mulder.
You don't see what's going on here, do you?
There's $45 million worth of damage to the city of Dallas. Lives have been lost. No suspects have been named. So the story that's being shaped is that this could have been prevented.
They want to blame us?
Agent Mulder, you and I both know that if it looks bad, it's bad for the FBI. Blame has to be assigned somewhere.
If they want somebody to blame, they can blame me. Agent Scully doesn't deserve this.
She's in there right now saying the same thing about you.
I breached protocol. I broke contact with the SAC. I ignored a primary tactical rule and left them alone with the device.
Agent Scully says it was she who ordered you out of the building, that you wanted to go back in.
No.
Scully steps into the hall and approaches them. Her dark-fitted skirt suit accentuates her slender figure.
They're asking for you, sir.
Thank you.
Skinner leaves. A tiny gold cross gleams on Scully's neck.
Whatever you told him in there, Scully, you don't have to protect me.
All I told him was the truth.
They're trying to divide us on this, and we can't let them.
Mulder, they have divided us. They're splitting us up.
What? What are you talking about?
I have a meeting with OPR day after tomorrow for remediation and reassignment.
Yeah, they were the ones that put us together.
Because they wanted me to invalidate your investigations into the paranormal, but I think this goes deeper than that now.
This is not about you, Scully. They're doing this to me.
They're not doing this. Mulder, I left behind a career in medicine because I thought that I could make a difference at the FBI. But it hasn't turned out that way. And now if they were to transfer me to Omaha or Cleveland or some field office, it just doesn't hold the interest for me that it once did. Not after what I've seen and done.
You're quitting.
Maybe you should ask yourself if your heart's still in it, too.
Agent Mulder, you're up.
I'm sorry.
Mulder steps toward the door.
Mulder.
Scully retrieves his suit coat from a bench and gives it to him.
Good luck.
As Mulder takes it in hand, their eyes briefly meet. He pulls on the coat and meets Skinner at the door. Left alone, Scully stares in the direction of the hearing room, then casts her gaze downward. She shifts awkwardly on her feet and walks away. Later, in a pub, a bartender fixes Mulder a drink.
I'd say this about exceeds your minimum daily requirement.
Mulder downs a shot, then clumsily plunks the glass down.
Whoa. You've got to train for that kind of heavy lifting. Day?
Mulder gestures a yes. As he orders another drink, he spots a gray-haired man watching him.
So, what do you do?
What do I do?
Mm-hmm. He sips another shot.
I'm the key figure in an ongoing government charade. The plot to conceal the truth about the existence of extraterrestrials. It's a global conspiracy, actually, with key players, the highest levels of power, and that reaches down into the lives of every man, woman, and child on this planet. So, of course, no one believes me. I'm an annoyance to my superiors, a joke to my peers. They call me Spooky. Spooky Mulder, whose sister was abducted by aliens when he was just a kid and now chases after little green men with a badge and a gun, shouting to the heavens or anyone who will listen that the fix is in, that the sky is falling. And when it hits, it's gonna be the shitstorm of all time.
Well, I would say that about does it, Spooky.
Does what?
Well, looks like 86 is your lucky number.
As he poises his lips to speak, the bartender shakes her head no. Groggily, Mulder takes some money out of his pocket.
You know, one is the loneliest number.
The bartender counts the wad of bills. As she faces the cash register, Mulder glances down the bar in the direction of the gray-haired man. The stranger is gone. Mulder gets up. He strides through the pub, which is decorated in a 19th century style. Dark wood paneling is fitted with frosted glass windows and brass foot rails. Mulder gloomily pulls on a sign taped to a door, out of order. He opens the door beside it.
Hello? Sorry.
Shifting on his feet, Mulder spots a back door marked with an exit sign. Now, in a moonlit alley, a poster for the movie Independence Day gleams dully on a wall. Mulder relieves himself on it. He tosses his head back with satisfaction.
That official FBI business?
The gray-haired man.
What? That the Bureau's accusing you of the same thing in Dallas. Standing around holding your yank while bombs are exploding.
Mulder looks up from his spot between two dumpsters, then turns his back to the old man.
Do I know you?
No, but I've been watching your career for a good while. Back when you were just a promising young agent. Before that.
You come out here for a reason?
Yeah, I did.
He unzips his fly.
My name is Kurzweil. Dr. Alvin Kurzweil.
Am I supposed to know that name?
Old friend of your father's. Back at the Department of State, we were what you might call fellow travelers, but his disenchantment outlasted mine.
Right.
Mulder heads for the pub's back door. Seeing him go, Kurzweil quickly finishes his business and follows him inside.
How'd you find me?
I heard you come in here now and again. Figured you'd be needing a little drinky tonight.
You a reporter?
I'm a doctor, but I think I mentioned that. OBGYN.
You got something to tell me? You got as much time as it takes for me to hail a cab.
They exit.
There's something you don't know about the bombing in Dallas.
What's that? SAC Darius Michaud never tried or intended to defuse that bomb.
They just let it explode in his face, huh?
What's a question no one's asking? Why that building? Why not the federal building?
The federal building was too well guarded.
No. They put the bomb in the building across the street because it did have federal offices there.
The Federal City Management Agency had a provisional medical quarantine office there, which is where the bodies were found.
But that's the thing you didn't know, the thing you'd never think to check. Those people were already dead.
Before the bomb went off.
That's what I'm saying.
Darius Michaud was a 22-year veteran of the Bureau.
Michaud was a patriot. The people he was loyal to know their way around Dallas. They blew that building to hide something, maybe even something they couldn't predict.
You're telling me they blew up that entire building just to hide the bodies of those firemen?
And one little boy.
I think you're full of shit.
Do you?
Kurzweil grins. Mulder gets into a taxi cab.
Arlington, please.
He glances drowsily at the cabbie. The taxi pulls away, leaving Kurzweil standing in his baggy suit on the wet curb. Now in the cab, Mulder gazes out the window. He shuts his eyes, then abruptly turns to the driver.
Actually, you know, let's go to Georgetown. Let's go to Georgetown.
He stares off with cool focus. Now, blackness. Our view drifts up, revealing the silhouetted hip and shoulder of a body lying in bed. Moonlight washes across the face of Scully as she rolls onto her back. The sheen of her silk pajamas picks up the sparkle in her troubled eyes. She gets up. Now, opening her door, she finds Mulder.
I woke you. Did I wake you?
No.
Why not? It's 3 in the morning.
Are you drunk, Mulder?
I was until about 20 minutes ago, yeah.
Was that before or after you decided to come here?
What exactly are you implying?
Go home, Mulder.
Get dressed.
It's late.
Get dressed.
What are you doing?
Just get dressed and I'll explain on the way.
Later, an enormous moon hangs on the horizon. Two helicopters appear and scour the barren terrain with searchlights. Words type out on screen, North Texas. The helicopters pass over three domed tents, glowing white from within. A flashing radio tower attached to them points skyward. One chopper passes overhead, its rotors slicing a blurry circle into the air. The helicopters touch down. The suburban neighborhood lies several hundred feet behind them. One chopper's door opens, and a shadowy man steps out. Two other men wait by the second chopper as the first faces the scientific tent site. He takes out a cigarette. Reaching into his suit pocket, the shadowy man pulls out a lighter. He cups it in his hand and lights up. He scans the domed tents. The skin of his face is weathered and furrowed like putty. Now, inside the tents, technicians, some in white lab coats, work with microscopes and elaborate consoles. One man pushes a steel tank on a dolly. He steers it past the hole in the ground where Stevie fell, which is now fitted with a concrete and metal ring and a ladder. A worker in a filtration suit climbs out. It's Braunschweig. He freezes. The cigarette-smoking man approaches, stepping past a pumping station where a clear pipe shows flowing black sludge.
You got something to show me.
Later, they descend into the cavern wearing filtration suits. A catwalk leads to a large glass booth filled with vapor.
We brought the atmosphere back down to freezing in order to control the development, which is like nothing we've ever seen.
Brought on by what?
Heat, I think. The coincident invasion of a host, the firemen, in an environment that raised his body temperature above 98.6.
One side of the booth is curtained off. Braunschweig slides the curtain back, revealing a human body with translucent skin.
This man's still alive.
Technically and biologically, but he'll never recover.
Long bony fingers move inside the clear chest cavity.
How can this be?
The developing organism is using his life energy, digesting bone and tissue. We've just slowed the process.
The cigarette-smoking man gapes pensively.
Do you want us to destroy this one, too, before it gestates?
No. We need to try our vaccine on it.
And if it's unsuccessful?
Burn it, like the others.
The gestating alien stirs, opening its large black eyes. Now, cars drive across a wide bridge at night. Words type out on screen, Montgomery County, Maryland. In a corridor, Mulder and Scully walk toward a boyish GI at a desk. More words appear. Bethesda Naval Hospital, 4:04 a.m.
ID and floor you're visiting, please.
We're going down to the morgue.
They show their badges.
That area is currently off limits to anyone other than authorized medical personnel.
On whose orders?
General McCaddy.
General McCaddy is who requested our coming down here. We were wakened at 3 a.m. and told to get down here immediately.
I don't know anything about that.
We'll call General McCaddy.
I don't have the number.
Well, then call the switchboard. They'll patch you through.
The GI checks a directory.
Jesus, you don't know the switchboard number?
I'm calling my CEO.
Listen, son, we don't have time to dick around while you demonstrate your ignorance in the chain of command. The order came directly from General McCaddy. You call him. We'll conduct our business while you confirm authorization.
Mulder and Scully stride past him.
Why don't you head on down, and I'll confirm authorization.
Thank you. Why is the morgue suddenly off limits on the orders of a general?
In the morgue, they locate a cloth-wrapped body.
This is one of the firemen who died in Dallas?
According to the toe tag.
And you're looking for?
Cause of death.
I can tell you that without even looking at him.
She reads a report.
Concussive organ failure due to proximal exposure to source and flying debris. Mulder, this man's already been autopsied. You can tell by the way he's been wrapped and dressed.
Mulder peels the cloth back. The body is clear and sticky.
Does this fit the description you just read me?
As he holds up the cloth, Scully's beside him for a look.
Oh my God, this man's tissue, Mulder.
It's like jelly.
There's been some kind of cellular breakdown.
She puts on a latex glove and presses her fingers against the cadaver's chest.
God, it's completely adamantous. There's been no autopsy performed here. No Y incision. No internal exam.
You're telling me the cause of death on that report is false? That this man didn't die from an explosion or from flying debris?
Well, no, I can't tell you what killed this man. I'm not sure anybody else could claim to either.
Now they wheel the body to an examination room.
Mulder, you knew before we got here this man didn't die at the bomb site.
I've been told as much.
You're saying this is a cover-up? Of what?
I don't know. But I have a hunch that what you're gonna find won't be anything that can be categorized or easily referenced.
Mulder, this is gonna take some time. Somebody's gonna figure out sooner or later that we're not even supposed to be here.
We are being blamed for this man's death. I'd like to know what he died of. Wouldn't you?
Scully watches Mulder leave, then turns her attention to the body. Later, outside, a taxi turns down a wet street. Words type out on screen. DuPont Circle, Washington, D.C., 4:50 a.m.
I think that's it up here.
Police cars idle outside a high-class apartment building. Inside, Mulder steps through an open door, finding an apartment in the midst of a police investigation. As officers sift through clutter, Mulder discovers a stack of journals on gynecology and obstetrics. A detective spots Mulder.
Excuse me, can I help you?
Is this Dr. Kurzweil's residence?
The pudgy detective eyes him.
You have some kind of business with him?
Yeah, I'm looking for him.
You're looking for him for what?
Mulder shows his FBI badge.
The feds are looking for him too. Real nice business he's got, huh?
What's that?
Selling naked pictures of little kids on his computer.
Mulder finds conspiracy theory books written by Kurzweil.
You looking for him for some other reason?
One is called Countdown to the Apocalypse.
Yeah. I had an appointment for a pelvic examination.
Mulder smiles, and the detective cracks a grin.
Hey, you want to call if we turn up this Kurzweil?
Don't bother.
Mulder leaves. Stepping onto the sidewalk, he looks down the street. Kurzweil peeks out from an alley and beckons with his finger. Mulder glances cautiously at two officers heading toward their squad car, then approaches the alley. Kurzweil ducks back, and Mulder rounds the corner, finding the grin waiting for him.
See this crap? Somebody knows I'm talking to you.
Not according to the men in blue.
Oh, what is it this time? Kiddie porn again? Sexual battery of a patient?
They want to discredit you for what?
Because I'm a dangerous man, because I know too much about the truth.
Now that end-of-the-world apocalyptic garbage, you're right?
You know my work?
Mulder turns to go.
I was right about Dallas, wasn't I?
Al, how are you right?
Are you familiar with the antivirus, Agent Mulder?
Yeah, it was a deadly virus spread by field mice in the southwestern United States several years ago.
According to the newspaper, FEMA was called out to manage an outbreak of the hantavirus. Are you familiar with what the Federal Emergency Management Agency's real power is? FEMA allows the White House to suspend constitutional government upon declaration of a national emergency. Think about that. What is an agency with such broad sweeping power doing managing a small viral outbreak in suburban Texas?
You're saying it wasn't such a small outbreak?
No. I'm saying it wasn't the hantavirus.
Well, what was it?
Patrol car drives by. Kurzweil heads farther down the alley.
What was it?
They cautiously watch the sidewalk.
When we were young men in the military, your father and I were recruited for a project. They told us it was biological warfare or a virus.
What killed those men?
What killed them, I won't even write about. We have no context for what killed those men, or any appreciation of the scale at which it'll be unleashed in the future.
A plague?
Plague to end all plagues, Agent Mulder. A silent weapon for a quiet war. The systematic release of an indiscriminate organism for which the men who will bring it on still have no cure. They've been working on this for 50 years. While the rest of the world have been fighting gooks and commies, these men have been secretly negotiating a planned Armageddon.
Negotiating with whom?
I think you know. The timetable has been set. It'll happen on a holiday when people are away from their homes. The president will declare a state of emergency, at which time all government, all federal agencies will come under the power of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, the secret government.
They call me paranoid.
Go back to Dallas, Agent Mulder, and dig. Or we're gonna find out along with the rest of the country. When it's too late.
Now, in the examination room in Bethesda, Scully leans over the opened-up corpse, her face protected by a doctor's mask and goggles. Working a pair of bone cutters, she breaks off a fragment of the chest cage and studies it. It's clear and pitted. Scully's eyes dart to the room's frosted glass windows. The blurry silhouettes of three figures march toward the door. The boyish GI and two guards find the room empty, except for the covered body lying at its center. Meanwhile, in a cold storage room, Scully pulls the door shut. She fumbles for her cell phone.
Hey, Scully, it's me.
Yeah?
Why are you whispering?
I'm over. I can't really talk right now.
What did you find?
Evidence of a massive infection.
What kind of infection?
I don't know.
All right, listen to me. I'm going home, and then I'm booking myself on a flight to Dallas.
I'm gonna get you a ticket, too.
Mulder.
I need you there with me. I need your expertise.
Mulder, I've got a hearing tomorrow.
I can get you back in time for that hearing.
And maybe with evidence that'll blow it away.
Mulder, I can't. I'm way past the point of common sense here.
It's not common sense.
Scully's gaze shoots to the door.
Are you there? Scully?
Now with Mulder.
Scully?
He hangs up. Now, the young GI opens the door to the cold storage room. He scans past two steel shelves, then paces in his black boots past a gurney. His boots stop. Scully lies under the gurney. Liquid drips onto the floor by her face. Now, as a passenger jet lands, words type on screen. Dallas, Texas, FBI field office, 11:21 a.m.
I'm afraid what you're looking for amounts to a needle in a haystack. This explosion was so devastating, there hadn't been much that we've been able to put together just yet.
Well, I'm looking for anything out of the ordinary, really. Maybe something from the FEMA offices where those bodies were found?
Well, we weren't expecting to find those remains, of course, when we sent them off to Washington.
Well, anything from those offices that you haven't sent off to D.C. yet?
Some bone fragments turned up in the SIF this morning. We thought we had another fatality, but we found out FEMA recovered them from an archaeological site out of town.
Have you examined them?
No, just fossils, as far as we know.
Scully enters, and Mulder points to her.
I'd like you to let this person take a look at them, if you don't mind.
The field agent glances at Scully.
Just let me see if I can lay my hands on what you're looking for.
He walks away.
I thought you said you weren't coming.
Wasn't planning on it, particularly not after spending half an hour in cold storage this morning. But I got a better look at the blood and tissue samples I took from the firemen.
And what did you find?
Something I couldn't show to anybody else, not without causing the kind of attention I'd just as soon avoid right now. But what those men were infected with contains a protein coat that I've never seen before. What it did to them, it did extremely fast.
How is it contracted?
That I don't know. But unless it can respond to conventional treatment, it could be a serious health threat.
The field agent returns.
Like I said, these are just fossils, but they weren't near the blast center, so they're not going to tell you much.
Right. Why don't you check this out?
Mulder hands Scully a vial containing bone fragments. She takes it over to a high-powered microscope, slides a sample in place, and peers into the eyepiece. She looks up at Mulder with a stunned gaze. Mulder looks at the field agent.
You said you knew the location where these were found?
Show you right on the map.
Mulder nods to Scully. Now, in a fenced backyard, children play on a swing set. One child scrambles up a slide and peers over the fence. The white domed tents sit on the barren field beyond. At the site, an empty body case hangs from a tractor's winch. Scientists hold it steady as the vehicle moves it toward the mouth of the pit. Braunschweig inspects the case's lid and studies a gauge mounted above two metal tanks.
I want all of these settings checked and recalibrated. I want a steady minus 2 degrees Celsius throughout the transfer of the body after I've administered the vaccine.
In the cavern, Braunschweig wears his filtration suit. He opens the door to the sealed glass booth. Inside, he positions a swing arm lamp over the fireman's degraded body. The rib cage is gone. The blood-smeared chest cavity lies open to the air. Braunschweig's eyes widen and shift nervously. He yanks off the hood of his suit and glances around the booth. Hurrying to the ladder, he looks up at two chatting technicians.
It's gone!
What?
It's left the body. I think it's gestated.
His eyes fix on the shadows.
What's the matter?
Wait. I can see it.
In a dark corner a few yards from Braunschweig, a fleshy mound rises and falls as it breathes.
Jesus, Lord.
You see it?
Yeah. So much for little green man.
He reaches into a pouch.
I need you down here.
The technicians above trade anxious glances. In the cavern, Braunschweig uncaps a syringe. He jabs the needle into a vial of dark liquid and fills the hypodermic. His gaze returns to the dark corner. The creature is gone. A blue glow from the cavern's installed lights edges the doctor's sweating face. His gaze pivots jerkily around, and he spots the creature. It stands, reaching 8 feet in height, then tilts its head and blinks. thick, pointy claws extend from its dripping fingers. Its skull-like face lunges. As the creature slashes into Braunschweig, he stabs it with the syringe. The creature's head wags violently, and it flees. The stunned technicians watch from above. Bleeding, Braunschweig grabs the ladder.
Help! I need help!
An 8-inch gash is sliced through his cheek. As he struggles to climb up, his colleagues cover the hole.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
Dirt pours over the plexiglass seal. Braunschweig clings to the ladder. His shredded suit glows in the dim blue light from the incubation booth. The creature's hand seizes his face. Now children play by a sunny mansion. Words appear. County of Somerset, England. On a nearby terrace, a well-manicured gentleman wearing a vest and tie sips tea. As he watches the children with a fond gaze, a butler approaches him.
Sir, you have a call.
He rises to his feet, tugs his vest flat, and steps indoors. Reaching an opulent dark wood study, he goes to a desk and lifts a telephone handset to his ear.
Yes.
We have a situation. The members are assembling.
Is it an emergency?
Yes.
The smoking man.
A meeting has been set tonight in London to determine a course.
Who called this meeting?
Strughold. He just got on a plane in Tunis.
The well-manicured man lowers the receiver and looks out a window. He hastens over to it and sees the children, their nanny, and the butler gathered around one child lying on the grass. He hurries outside. Later, a double-decker bus drives along a winding city block. Words type out on screen, London, England, 6:47 a.m. A black sedan stops before a brick facade. The well-manicured man gets out, met by a valet.
Has Strughold arrived?
Yes. They're waiting in the library, sir.
Now, inside, a dozen men wearing dark suits gather around a video monitor. As the well-manicured man enters, they all face him. A balding, white-haired fellow in a chair stands.
We begin to worry. Some of us have traveled so far, and you are the last to arrive. I'm sorry. My grandson fell and broke his leg. While we've been made to wait, we watch surveillance tapes, which have raised more concerns. More concerns than what? We've been forced to reassess our role in colonization by new facts of biology which have presented themselves.
The virus has mutated.
Into what?
A new extraterrestrial biological entity.
My God.
The geometry of mass infection presents certain conceptual re-evaluations for us about our place in their colonization.
This isn't colonization. This is spontaneous repopulation. All our work, if it's true, they've been using us all along. We've been laboring under a lie.
It could be an isolated case.
How can we know?
We are going to tell them what we found, what we've learned, by turning over a body infected with the gestating organism.
In hope of what? Learning that it's true? That we are nothing but digestives for the creation of a new race of alien life forms? By cooperating now, we are but beggars to our own demise.
Cooperation is the only chance of saving ourselves.
They still need us to carry out their preparations.
We'll continue to use them as they do us, if only to play for more time to continue work on our vaccine.
My lateness might just as well have been absence. A course has already been taken.
There are complications. Mulder saw one of the infected bodies that we destroyed in Dallas. He's gone back there again. Someone has tipped him.
Who?
Kurzweil, we think.
No one believes Kurzweil or his books. He's a toiler, a crank.
Mulder believes him.
Then Kurzweil must be removed.
Yes, must Mulder.
Kill Mulder. We take the risk of turning one man's quest into a crusade.
then you must take away what he holds most valuable, that with which he can't live without.
Now, Scully surveys the dusty suburb in North Texas.
I don't know, Mulder. I don't see any evidence of an archaeological or any other kind of a dig site.
This is where he marked on the map, where he said those fossils were unearthed. You're sure those fossils were infected with the same virus you saw at the morgue?
Both sets of bones were porous, as if the virus or the causative microbe were decomposing it.
And you've never seen that virus before?
No.
Mulder notices a lush lawn.
Look at that.
In the stiff breeze, they stride toward it. The tract of healthy grass forms a large green rectangle on the barren dust field. On it, a freshly painted slide, swing set, and jungle gym make up a tidy playground.
That look like new grass to you?
Looks pretty green for this climate.
Uh-huh.
Mulder kneels and easily peels back a patch of the green sod.
Ground's dry about an inch down. This was laid recently.
The equipment looks brand new, too.
No irrigation system. Somebody's covering their tracks.
Mulder spots three kids, Stevie's friends, approaching on shiny dirt bikes.
Hey! Hey!
You boys live around here?
Yeah.
You seen anybody digging over there?
We're not supposed to talk about it.
You're not supposed to talk about it. Who told you that?
Nobody.
Nobody? Same nobody to build that playground? Nobody buy you those new bikes, too?
I think you better tell us.
We don't even know you.
Well, we're FBI agents.
You're not FBI agents.
How do you know?
Because y'all look like door-to-door salesmen.
Scully cracks a grin. Mulder shows his ID.
Hey, you want to buy a badge?
They all left an hour ago. Yeah.
Going that way.
The boys point across the flats. Later, the FBI agent's distant sedan follows a road across an arid plain. Our view descends alongside the speeding car, whipping past dry shrubs.
Unmarked tanker trucks. What are archaeologists hauling out the tanker trucks?
I don't know, Mulder.
Where are they going with it?
What's the first question to answer if we're going to find them?
They stop at a T-shaped intersection. Scully studies a map.
What are my choices?
About 100 miles and nothing in both directions.
Well, which way do you think they went?
You got two choices. One of them's wrong.
Mulder drums the steering wheel.
I think they went left.
I don't know why. I think they went right.
They trade a quick glance. Mulder pulls forward. He goes straight. The car's chassis bounces as they cruise over the dusty earth.
5 years together, Scully. How many times have I been wrong?
Never.
Scully gives a half smile.
Not driving, anyway.
The sedan races along a dirt road. On either side, the parched earth extends to the horizon. Above it, a line of pink-orange clouds hangs in the darkening sky, and the car grows distant and small. Nighttime. The car's far-off headlights travel swiftly past a stand of trees. A barbed wire fence blocks their path. Scully casts an irritated gaze in Mulder's direction, gets out, and slams the door. As she steps away from the car, Mulder gets out.
I was right about the bomb, wasn't I?
This is great. This is fitting.
What?
I have to be in Washington, D.C. in 11 hours for a hearing, the outcome of which might possibly affect one of the biggest decisions of my life. And here I am in the middle of nowhere, Texas, chasing phantom tanker trucks.
We're not chasing tanker trucks, Scully. We're chasing evidence.
Of what exactly?
That bomb in Dallas was allowed to go off to hide something. Bodies infected with a virus you yourself detected.
Mulder, they haul oil in tanker trucks. They haul gas in tanker trucks. They do not haul viruses in tanker trucks.
Well, they may be hauling a virus in these tanker trucks.
What do you mean, Mulder? What are you not telling me? Mulder.
The virus may be extraterrestrial.
She gapes. Mulder flashes a goofy, embarrassed smile.
Mulder, I don't...
Behind the fence, a railroad crossing sign flashes red. Mulder watches a distant train approach. As he steps intently toward the tracks, Scully gives an annoyed shrug. The diesel engine passes, pulling a number of boxcars. The headlights from Mulder's sedan throw his shadow onto the last freight cars, two flatbeds with unmarked tanker truck trailers loaded onto them. The two FBI agents swap an intrigued glance. They get into the sedan. As they accelerate down a road parallel to the tracks, the train passes another crossing. The unmarked tanker trailers stream by, and Mulder drives the sedan across the tracks. As the train disappears into a tunnel, the sedan's upward along an adjacent mountain road. Now, the sedan stops on a flat overlook. Mulder and Scully get out of the car, their eyes riveted on the view below.
What do you think they are?
I have no idea.
Scully stares ahead, and the two agents hike down the rocky slope. In the distance, two huge white domes cast a stark glow across a field of crops. The freight train rolls toward them. At the foot of the rocky slope, Mulder and Scully jog across a stretch of gravel and find mature corn stalks. Brushing the long leaves aside, they file between the tall rows.
This is weird, Mulder.
Very weird.
Any thoughts as to why anybody would be growing corn in the middle of the desert?
It'll be giant Jiffy Pop poppers.
They step deeper into the cornfield. The blimp-sized domes loom ahead. Each is made from white cloth pulled tightly over a frame of metal ribs. Now, Mulder and Scully exit the field beside one dome, which rises five stories into the dark sky. Scully glances inquisitively at Mulder, who gives her a baffled frown. Approaching the second dome, they find a set of double doors. Near the doors, the dome's white cloth bulges as though inflated. Mulder pulls open one of the doors. Air from within blows their clothes and hair. Inside, a short corridor leads to a spacious chamber, bisected by a catwalk. They jump aside as overhead fans in the corridor blow air through louvered ceiling panels. Slowly, they cross the spacious chamber.
It's cool in here. The temperature's being regulated.
For the purpose of what?
Mulder, I think we're on top of a larger structure here. This is some kind of a venting system.
You hear something? You hear that?
Dozens of large louvered panels line the floor.
I hear a humming.
Mm-hmm.
Like electricity. High voltage, maybe.
Maybe.
As Mulder presses his ear to one panel's closed louvers, Scully spots more on the ceiling.
Maybe not.
Mulder's eyes fix on the panels overhead. The louvers rotate open.
Scully?
Yeah?
Run!
The floor panels open in rapid sequence. Thousands of bees swarm up, filling the dome. Mulder and Scully pull their jackets over their heads and sprint for the doors. Scully lags behind.
Scully!
Mulder heads back. Side by side, they race toward the double doors. As they reach the short corridor, the bees drop to the ground. Scully and Mulder flee outside. Scully shakes the unbelted front of her long coat.
Did you get stung?
I don't think so.
Scully's gold cross glimmers on her neck as she brushes back her hair. She follows Mulder away from the dome, and they spot a hazy beam of light shifting jerkily over the cornfield. The light intensifies, and they glimpse an airborne craft skimming over the stalks. Mulder and Scully run into the field behind them. Two helicopters follow. As Scully and Mulder race through the dense cornfield, the choppers scour the field with their powerful searchlights. On the ground, Mulder and Scully shove through the corn. The long leaves lash past their faces. One chopper dives low. As Scully drops on all fours, Mulder continues to run. The turbulent air whips through the corn stalks, and Mulder ducks down. The brilliant lights pass over Scully, then soar along the corn row past Mulder. He runs. The choppers double back.
Talk to me, Scully! Scully! Damn it! Scully! Hey!
Scully makes a run for it. As the choppers sweep the area by the domes, Mulder stops.
Scully! Scully! Scully!
Mulder!
Scully races up a corn row and glances over her shoulder. Mulder bolts as the choppers swoop near. Close behind him, the roving searchlights glow through the green leaves. The helicopters dart just yards above the corn stalks. As the choppers break off in opposite directions, Mulder reaches the field's edge. Scully exits the field 50 feet to his left, and they join up.
Where'd they go?
They rush to the foot of the rocky slope.
Come on.
Scully hustles uphill. The cloth belt of her coat swings loosely at her sides. She eyes the distant domes. Later, at the Office of Professional Review, the chairwoman looks at her watch. In the hall, Skinner's impatiently. Scully arrives, brushing off the same dark pantsuit from the night before. She shoots a nervous glance at Skinner and smooths her hair. Skinner returns to the hearing room.
She's coming in.
As she enters, Scully shoots an abashed gaze at the center table and promptly takes a seat.
Special Agent Scully?
Yes, I apologize for making you wait. I have new evidence.
Evidence of what?
These are fossilized bone fragments that I've been able to study that were gathered at the site in Dallas.
You've been back to Dallas?
Yes.
Meanwhile, at the Smoky Pub, Mulder strides past a jukebox. Wearing blue jeans and a leather jacket, he joins Kurzweil at a booth.
You found something?
Yeah. On the Texas border, some kind of experiment. Something they excavated was brought there in tanker trucks.
What?
I'm not sure. A virus, I think.
And I also have reason to believe that there may have been some involvement by Special Agent in Charge Michaud.
Those are very serious allegations, Agent Scully.
Yes, I know.
You saw this experiment?
Yeah, but we were chased off.
What did it look like?
There were bees, corn crops.
And you have conclusive evidence of this? Something to tie this claim of yours to the crime?
Not completely conclusive. I hope to, but we are...
A honeybee crawls from under her collar.
We're working towards gathering that evidence.
Working with?
The bee crawls back underneath.
With Agent Mulder.
What are they? What do you think? Transportation system. Transgenic crops, the pollen genetically altered to carry a virus. That would be my guess.
Kurzweil gets up and walks away.
Guess? What do you mean, your guess? Hey, you told me you had answers.
Yeah, well, I don't have all.
You didn't know my father.
Like I told you, he and I were old friends.
You've been using me.
What do you mean?
You've been using me to gather information for your goddamn books.
Kurzweil hurries out the back exit. Mulder follows.
Kurzweil!
You know, you'd be shit out of luck if it wasn't for me. You saw what you saw because I led it. I'm putting my ass on the line for
your ass? I just got chased through Texas by two black helicopters.
And why do you think it is you're standing here talking to me? These people don't make mistakes.
As Kurzweil marches off down the alley, Mulder glances overhead. Through the grating of a fire escape, he spots a man in a gray suit watching him. The man disappears into an upper doorway. Mulder runs back inside. Later, arriving at his apartment, he tosses aside his leather coat and sits at his desk. He opens a drawer and lifts out a photo album. Leafing through it, he pages to a photo of his family gathered around a picnic table. Standing behind the table, with a raised glass and a full head of dark brown hair, is a 30-ish Kurzweil. Mulder looks over his shoulder. Scully enters slowly.
What's wrong?
Salt Lake City, you transfer effective immediately. I already gave Skinner my letter of resignation.
You can't quit now, Scully.
I can, Mulder. I debated whether or not even to tell you in person.
We are close to something here. We're on the verge.
You're on the verge, Mulder. Please don't do this to me.
After what you saw last night, after all you've seen, you can just walk away?
I have. I did. It's done.
I need you on this, Scully.
You don't need me, Mulder. You never have. I've just held you back. I gotta go.
She heads out. Mulder marches into the hall after her.
You want to tell yourself that so you can quit with a clear conscience? You can, but you're wrong.
Why did they assign me to you in the first place, Mulder? To debunk your work, to rein you in, to shut you down.
But you saved me. As difficult and as frustrating as it's been sometimes, your goddamn strict rationalism and science have saved me 1,000 times over. You've kept me honest. You made me a whole person. I owe you everything. Scully, you owe me nothing.
Scully's eyes flutter in deep thought.
I don't know if I want to do this alone. I don't even know if I can. And if I quit now, they win.
Scully lifts her gaze to meet his, her eyes pooled with tears. Shaking her faintly, she leans her face on his chest and they hold each other. Scully stares off, her blue eyes peek above Mulder's strong shoulder. As they relax their clinging, Scully holds the back of Mulder's neck. She presses her lips to his brow, then leans her forehead against his. Mulder looks into her eyes, cradling her head in his hands. A tear rolls down Scully's cheek as she meets his gaze full on. Her lips stifle a smile, then relax as Mulder leans in. His tender gaze and poised lips hover closer. She shuts her eyes and parts her lips. She swats the back of her neck.
Something stung me.
She pulls the wriggling honeybee from under her collar.
You must have gotten your shirt.
Mulder?
Hmm?
Something's wrong.
What?
I'm having lacerating pain in...
What?
My chest.
As she quavers,
Scully.
Mulder holds her up.
Motor functions are affected.
Mulder lays her on the floor.
Back of my throat.
I think you're going into anaphylactic shock.
No, I have no allergy.
Mulder races into his apartment and grabs the phone.
This is Special Agent Fox, Mulder, I have an emergency. I have an agent down.
Later, EMTs load Scully into an ambulance.
Can you say your name? She's got constriction in the throat and larynx. Okay. Passages are open. Okay, let's get her in the van right away. Look out, coming through. Watch your back.
She said she had a funny taste in the back of her throat, but there was no pre-existing allergy to bee sting. Now, the bee that stung her might have been carrying a virus.
Virus?
Yeah, you tell that to
get
the doctor.
Get on the radio. Tell him we got a cytogenetic reaction.
They shut the doors. Mulder approaches the driver.
What hospital are you taking her to?
The driver pulls a gun. Mulder drops to the ground and the ambulance pulls away. Still breathing, Mulder slowly rolls his head. Dark, glistening blood covers his left temple. The flashing red lights of a second ambulance grow larger as it approaches. Now, on a runway at night, a jet taxis across the wet tarmac. The jet maneuvers slowly toward a parked cargo truck. Two headlights shine brilliantly above the aircraft's front landing gear. Now, light floods into the truck's cargo hold, illuminating an airtight body case. Soldiers wheel it off onto a hydraulic lift beside the jet. The platform rises and locks into place, level with the jet's cargo hold. More soldiers move the body case inside, sliding it easily across rollers in the floor. In the nearby shadows, the cigarette-smoking man lights up and watches the case being loaded in. Scully lies inside the case. The soldiers push it along tracks and clamp it down. The soldiers exit through a rapidly closing hatch, leaving the cigarette-smoking man inside. In the darkening hold, the tip of his cigarette glows orange.
What are you doing?
Reading this chart.
Put it down.
Put it down when I'm ready.
Both of you should.
I think he's coming out.
He's coming too.
Now, three geeky men huddle over a hospital bed.
Hey, Mulder.
Mulder?
Mulder opens his eyes.
Oh, God.
One's long-haired, one's balding, and one wears a suit.
Cowardly lion, scarecrow, dodo.
Mulder grins. His friends, the lone gunman, smirk.
What am I doing here?
The bullet grazed your brow and glanced off your temporal plate.
3 centimeters to the left, and we all be playing harps right now.
You've been unconscious since they brought you in. Where's Scully?
We put together you called 911, but that call must have been intercepted.
Scully had a reaction to an Africanized honeybee we found in your hall.
As Mulder leaps up, Skinner enters.
Mulder, easy, easy. You're staying right here.
You don't understand. This goes right back to Dallas.
Tell me where she is. I'll find
her. I don't know where she is, but I can think of someone who might.
You leave here unprotected. How far will you get? How far will they let you get? Because they'll know the minute you walk out of here.
What can we do?
Mulder looks at his friend in the suit.
You can strip Byers naked.
What?
I need your clothes.
Later in the hall, a man standing watch a few yards away reads a paper with his back to the door. The balding guy and his long-haired friend step out. As the man in the suit walks down the hall, the guard watches him from behind. As all three go, the guard peers into Mulder's room. The bandaged patient lies on his side facing the far wall, and Skinner chats nonchalantly on his cell phone. Now free, Mulder uses his cell phone.
It's Mulder.
Mulder's two friends open a door for him. Later, out in the night air, Mulder jogs across a busy street. Running down the sidewalk, he takes off the borrowed suit coat and tosses it aside. Meanwhile, in the alley behind the pub, Kurzweil ambles along, shooting nervous glances left and right. He checks his wristwatch, steps over a puddle, and strides up to the pub's back door. He pulls it open and freezes. The well-manicured man stands facing him.
Dr. Kurzweil, isn't it? Dr. Alvin Kurzweil?
Kurzweil backs away. As he retreats, a car pulls into the alley and heads him off. He stops dead in his tracks, his frightened face lit up by the oncoming headlights. As the car stops, Kurzweil's gaze shoots to the well-manicured man, then returns to the car. Now Mulder enters the smoky pub and storms up to the bar, sweat gleams on his face. Several chatting customers hush up, stunned at the sight of him. Mulder stiffens his lips and marches past the jukebox to the booth where he last met Kurzweil. Finding it empty, he continues to the back door. He finds the well-manicured man and his driver shutting the car's trunk.
Mr. Mulder.
The back door swings on its hinges.
What happened to Kurzweil?
He's come and gone.
I want to know where Scully is.
The location of Agent Scully and the means to save her life. Please.
He holds up a small pouch and gestures for Mulder to get in the car. Mulder's stern gaze fixes on the well-manicured man. Keeping his eyes trained on the gentleman, he steps toward the car. The dim alley light traces the manicured man's baggy eyes and sunken cheeks. The two men get in, and the car pulls away across the rain-soaked pavement. Later, the dark sedan turns onto a city boulevard lined with trees. The floodlit dome of the Capitol building glows in the distance. Inside the car, Mulder accepts the pouch.
What is it? A weak vaccine against the virus Agent Scully has been infected with. It must be administered within 96 hours. That leaves you little time to reach those coordinates.
A handwritten note.
You're lying.
No. Though I have no means to prove otherwise. The virus is extraterrestrial. We know very little about it except that it was the original inhabitant of this planet.
A virus.
What is a virus? But a colonizing force that cannot be defeated, living in a cave underground until it mutates and attacks.
This is what you've been conspiring to conceal? A disease?
No, for God's sake, you've got it all backwards. AIDS, the Ebola virus, on an evolutionary scale, they are newborns. This virus walked the planet long before the dinosaurs.
What do you mean, walked?
Your aliens, Agent Mulder, your little green men, arrived here millions of years ago. Those that didn't leave have been lying dormant underground since the last ice age in the form of an evolved pathogen, waiting to be reconstituted by the alien race when it comes to colonize the planet, using us as hosts. Against this, no defense, nothing but a weak vaccine. Do you see why it was kept secret? Why even the best men, men like your father, could not let the truth be known. Until Dallas, we believed the virus would simply control us, that mass infection would make us a slave race. Imagine our surprise when they began to gestate. My group has been working cooperatively with the alien colonists, facilitating programs like the one you saw to give us access to the virus. In hope that we might be able secretly to develop a cure.
To save your own asses.
Survival is the ultimate ideology. Your father wisely refused to believe this.
But he sacrificed my sister. He let them take Samantha.
Without a vaccination, the only true survivors of the viral holocaust will be those immune to it. Human alien clones. He allowed your sister to be abducted, to be taken to a cloning program for one reason.
So she would survive. As a genetic hybrid.
Your father chose hope over selfishness. Hope in the only future he had, his children. His hope for you was that you would uncover the truth about the project, that you would stop it, that you would fight the future.
In the rearview mirror, the driver watches the conversing men.
Why are you telling me this?
For the sake of my own children. Once it's learned what I've told you, my life will be over.
Mulder and the well-manicured man glance at the rearview mirror. The reflection shows the driver's eyes watching the road.
Where's Dr. Kurzweil?
The well-manicured man stares at Mulder grimly.
I'd like to get out of the car now.
Stop the car!
Driver.
In the mirror, the driver's eyes watch them. With the glowing capital far behind them, the black sedan turns onto a street skirted by rundown industrial buildings. The car stops, and the headlights turn off. In his seat, Mulder repeatedly pulls at the door handle.
The men I work with will stop at nothing to clear the way for what they believe is their stake in the inevitable future.
The gentleman holds a gun.
I was ordered to kill Dr. Kurzweil. As I was ordered to kill you.
He aims at the driver.
Ow!
Blood spatters Mulder's face.
Trust no one, Mr. Mulder.
Grimacing, Mulder watches the man step out of the car.
Get out of the car.
Mulder leans back with a woozy sigh.
Why? The upholstery's already ruined.
Get out of the car.
Mulder complies. Standing by the open car door, he gazes inside toward the dead driver.
You have precious little time. What I've given you, the alien colonists don't yet know exists. The vaccine you hold is the only defense against the virus. Its introduction into an alien environment may have the power to destroy the delicate plans we have so assiduously protected for the last 50 years.
What do you mean, may have?
Find Agent Scully. Only then will you realize the scope and grandeur of the project. Go.
He aims the gun.
Go now.
Facing the barrel of the pistol, Mulder shifts on his feet, then turns and walks away. As Mulder puts more distance between them, a rat scurries across his path. The well-manicured man gets back into the car. Devastating fire blasts through the car, blowing out the doors and tossing ignited debris across the pavement. On the ground, Mulder sits up. Orange light flickers on his face as he watches the inferno. Plumes of fire jet from the car's windows and flare above its warped roof. Now, Mulder checks the contents of the small pouch. He gets to his feet and dashes away. At the burning car, the driver's side door, flung open from the blast, swings loosely on its hinges. Black smoke fogs up the windshield. Our view fades to an expanse of smooth snow. At the horizon, far off, an exposed rocky peak makes a dark sliver against the sky. Beyond a snow dune, a tiny, distant vehicle cuts a slow path across the flats. Words appear. Wilkesland, Antarctica, 48 hours later. The cycling treads of the vehicle, a snowcat, rip steadily through the powder. Mulder drives, wearing a heavy coat and thick gloves. Squinting, he wipes misty condensation off the windshield and peers over the steering wheel at a chain of low gray mountains. Behind him, the vehicle's tracks stretch far into the distance. The fuel gauge shows a quarter tank. Mulder taps it, and the needle jerks toward the E. Mulder glances at a digital compass. He stops the snowcat. He reads the digital display of his GPS monitor, 83 degrees south by 63 degrees east. The numbers match the coordinates on the note from the well-manicured man. With an exasperated shrug, Mulder scans the desolate landscape. Humps of rock poke from a snowy hill in front of him. Later, he climbs to its top and quickly ducks down. He spots a camp. He reaches into his jacket. The campsite lies at the center of a huge basin. Mulder looks through binoculars. He sees four snowcats and a permanent structure of five connected domes. Mulder lowers the binoculars. Wind rustles his hair and fur-lined hood. As he peers through the lenses a second time, he sees the cigarette-smoking man walking to one of the snowcats. Exhaling smoke, the man climbs into the vehicle's cab, and the snowcat lurches forward. Mulder pockets the binoculars and GPS monitor. He sets off across the hilltop toward the basin. Now, Mulder jogs across the field, his plodding footfall up tiny bursts of snow. Still several hundred yards away, the camp's domes gleam in the sunlight. The soft pack under Mulder's feet gives. Mulder plummets 50 feet, crashing through several giant air pockets in the snow. Landing in a crevasse, he winces and stretches his arms. Sunlight far above shines into the misty crevasse. Leaning on a wall of ice to catch his breath, Mulder gets to his feet. On the ground to his right, the mist is drawn by powerful suction into a 2-foot drain hole in the snow. Mulder peers down into it, then gazes up at the patch of blue sky far overhead. He looks back down into the drain hole. Now, inside a tube-shaped crawlspace, a light at the end grows brighter. Mulder drops inside it from above. Mulder spits. Discerning a spot of light at the tube's far end, he crawls toward it. In the pitch black, the circle of light ahead resembles a full moon. Mulder inches closer and comes to a downward bend in the tube. The passage leads out through the mouth of a thick pipe. Mulder backs out. Icy vapor flows over his legs as his body slides from the large spout. He lands feet first onto a metal floor. He finds himself in a long corridor. Patches of glowing green ice line the walls. The glowing patches are as tall as he is and bulge over the walkway. Mulder takes out a flashlight and points the beam around. Facing the wall, Mulder brushes loose snow from one of the bulges. The flashlight shines through the ice, illuminating a human face. Two eyes, lifeless and milky pink, stare out from its sunken, translucent skin. A waxy tube extends from the mouth. Mulder brushes away more snow, revealing a dark gray block with handles. A foot lower, he finds a gestating alien, its large black eyes half shut. Now above ground. The snowcat with the cigarette-smoking man inside it follows the tracks to Mulder's stalled snowcat. The smoking man takes a deep drag as he eyes the trail of footprints leading away from the stalled vehicle. Now, in the underground corridor, Mulder faces two circular archways, their frames lined with cog-like teeth. He hops through one. Just inside, the passage drops sharply. Mulder inches toward the edge. He finds a deep, misty shaft. Glowing green pods hang from the steeply angled ceiling. Each 6-foot pod has metal on one side. Mulder returns to the two circular archways. Between them, he discovers a narrow gap. He steps through onto a catwalk whose metal grid is caked with clay. The walkway ends, overlooking a stadium-sized chamber. Hundreds of thick black pipes line the outermost wall and converge inward, forming an aperture in the center the size of a house. Mulder surveys the space. Far below him, the spoke-like arrangements of piping open up into huge racks. The hanging gestation pods number in the hundreds. The cocoon-like pods slide along automated rails. Mulder's nervous gaze flits left and right. The rack directly below him draws his attention. His brow creases in concentration, and he takes out his binoculars. His view focuses on the body case lying empty on a platform. Mulder glares. Behind him, he finds a steep chute recessed into the wall. It leads to the platform below. Horizontal notches spaced along the chute function as rungs. As Mulder uses them to climb down, he plants the toes of his boots in a notch glistening with slime. His feet slip out and his fingers begin to lose their grip.
Shit.
Sliding down the chute, he aims his feet for a crosspiece. His high velocity throws him out of the chute and leaves him dangling over a 1,000-foot drop. His binoculars fall from his pocket. Mulder grits his teeth. Hanging by his hands, he works his way toward a ledge to the right. His dangling legs flail a little as he slings his hips and shifts his gripping hands. He reaches the ledge and pauses to catch his breath. He sits briefly, then takes out his flashlight. Mulder stands atop a huge cylindrical duct covered with corrosion. He crouches down and slides onto the platform below. He approaches the empty body case. Kneeling beside it, he finds Scully's coat and blouse. The beam of his flashlight shines on her glimmering gold cross. He picks it up. Squeezing it in his fist, he moves on. Mulder steps between two rows of the hanging green gestation pods and shines his flashlight on one. A man's face, pale but healthy, stares blankly from the watery pod. A tube trails from his mouth. Mulder looks at other pods. A woman's hair sways like seaweed. A man's eyes are ringed with irritated red skin. Mulder turns around and gapes. Scully stares out through a pod's glowing green water. The beam from Mulder's flashlight dances across her smooth cheeks and blue eyes. Mulder slaps the clear faceplate that separates them, then bangs on it with the butt of his flashlight. Now, above ground, the roving snowcat returns to camp. Inside one dome, the smoking man addresses men in rugged black clothes.
Secure the station. I want everyone else down below. If you're not armed, arm yourselves. We may have a breach.
Underground, Mulder removes an oxygen tank from the body case. He rams Scully's pod with the tank. The faceplate cracks. Now above ground.
Let's go! Let's go!
Now Mulder breaks through the faceplate. As the water pours out, draining below Scully's chin, Mulder tears away chunks of the icy shell. Scully's face appears frozen in an astonished gaze. Mulder gets out the syringe and the vial of vaccine that he got from the well-manicured man. He pokes the hypodermic needle through the vial's top and draws back the plunger. Looking at Scully, he sees gray gel travel up the waxy tube into her mouth. Mulder injects the vaccine into Scully's shoulder. Scully blinks.
Scully?
The gel turns brown and blue and reverses direction. The tube shrivels. He reaches for it. A tremor rocks the corridor. Around, a computer reads, contaminant detected.
There's a contaminant in the system.
The smoking man gapes.
Mulder has the vaccine.
Now, in the upper corridors of gestation pods, steam jets from the floor. Back with Mulder, Scully struggles to gulp air. The shriveled tube blocks her mouth. Mulder plucks it out and pulls another 5 feet of tubing from her throat.
Breathe. Scully, can you breathe?
Cold. Cold.
Get you out of there.
Mulder caresses her cheek. Above ground, sparks shower the control room.
Abandon your post! Evacuate!
A console displays the word error, and yellow emergency lights flash on the walls. A technician jogs up to the smoking man.
What's happened?
It's all going to hell.
But what about Mulder?
He'll never make it.
Underground, Mulder pries back a large clamp on Scully's pod. Then, wrapping his arms around her bare back, he lays her down gently. Later, he carries her. Scully wears Mulder's hooded coat and thermal pants. Mulder steps down a cylindrical passage where a lone gestation pod swings from the ceiling. He sidles by it and halts. He finds himself at a dead end on the bottom of a vertical shaft over 50 feet high. Now above ground. Outside, men evacuate the white domes and run for the snowcats. The smoking man plods calmly to one vehicle. As he climbs in, the driver starts the engine. The smoking man looks straight ahead, his gaze hollow and spent. Underground, Mulder holds Scully and climbs the notched bars on the shaft wall. Elsewhere, water pours down the front of one of the glowing green pods. Inside it, the human host's abdomen quivers and swells. In an adjacent pod, a long-fingered hand scratches at the icy faceplate. Now, as Mulder and Scully reach the shaft's halfway point, the snowcats at the camp drive off. They pass by the now steaming hole where Mulder fell through. In the alien catacombs, Scully and Mulder reach the top of the shaft. Mulder gives Scully a push as she crawls to safety. Scully sits down to rest.
We gotta keep moving.
Come on.
I can't.
Mulder carries Scully along the upper corridor he entered by. The bulging ice wall has melted, revealing thawed gestation pods. As alien hands grope inside them, Mulder finds the wide-mouthed spout overhead. Steam issues from it.
Scully, reach up and grab that vent.
Mulder stares into a pod where an alien shakes its head.
Scully, grab the vent!
Scully?
Mulder lays her down. Her eyes are shut and her body limp. Mulder quickly opens her coat, then glances up at the thawing pod. The wet alien inside convulses. As it tears a stringy, oozing membrane off its head, Mulder glances around. More aliens waken. One blinks and flexes its jaws. Mulder gives Scully mouth to mouth.
Jeez, breathe.
Glancing at the pods, he performs chest compressions on Scully.
Breathe. Breathe in. Breathe in. Breathe.
As she tries to speak, he leans close.
I had you big time.
They grin. Now, all around them, the pod clamps begin popping open, spraying shards of ice. One alien headbutts its faceplate, cracking it. Mulder lifts Scully to the spout. He gapes as an alien punches out of its shell.
Whoa! Come on, Scully! Whoa!
Scully enters the tube.
Mulder.
As Mulder climbs up, an alien grabs his foot. Mulder kicks free. As another alien lunges, Mulder escapes into the pipe.
Keep moving, Scully!
Mulder follows Scully as they crawl through the shoulder-wide tube. Patches on the wall glow bright orange.
Almost there. Keep going.
Scully climbs up the drain to the now slushy crevasse. In the tube, our view charges toward Mulder as he scrambles out. An alien leaps up, then disappears in a column of steam. Mulder looks into the drain and finds only snow bathed in orange light. Now he supports Scully and looks around the dim crevasse. The two agents step over the drain, moving toward brighter light. As they clear the pipe, steam explodes from inside it. Now Scully and Mulder pull themselves from the sinkhole into the sunlight. As Mulder crouches by Scully, numerous steam geysers scattered around the snowy basin blast hot mist into the air. The icy rim around the sinkhole begins to crack. Mulder pulls Scully to her feet. They scramble a few feet from the edge, then pause to listen. Collapsing ground swallows the campsite of domed buildings. Mulder helps Scully to run. The hole at the basin center grows. Massive chunks of the glacial field break off and drop. The crumbling edge advances towards Scully and Mulder, who run as fast as they can. Steam shoots up beside them, and they fall. As they recover, cracks snake rapidly through the ice under their feet. The field crumbles beneath them, and they drop out of sight. Now, they rise on a wall of mist, and the rim of the basin appears to shatter upward. Scully and Mulder slide down a black slope and drop safely onto the basin's edge. A black spacecraft the size of an island lifts off behind them. Scully lies face down in the snow as Mulder watches the enormous hovercraft glide overhead. Green lights in elaborate patterns glow on the ship's underside. Black ducts and pipes are arranged like a wheel's spokes around a central recessed bay. Mulder gapes as the ship drifts toward the horizon. He puts his arm around Scully. Still face down, Scully's eyes open groggily, then shut. Mulder watches alone as the alien craft disappears into a ceiling of dark clouds. As he grins, Scully opens her heavy eyes and looks at him. Mulder glances in the direction of the vanished ship. His eyes close, and his head settles into the snow. Scully sees him go still. She crawls close and heaves him onto her lap. Clutching him from behind, her arms wrap under Mulder's chin. Mulder has a dark welt on his forehead. Scully presses her mouth into his wet hair and rocks him back and forth. On the vast snowfield, wind buffets the huddled pair. Beside their distant forms, the field ends at a sheer drop into a deep blue crater. The crater is larger than the mouth of a volcano, and tiny plumes of steam rise from its immense concave wall. A great cloud of mist hovers in the blue void. Fade to black. Now, in the hearing room.
In light of the report I've got before me, in light of the narrative I'm now hearing, my official report is incomplete.
Meanwhile, a man enters the dark FBI field office.
Agent Scully, though there's now direct evidence that a federal agent may have been involved in the bombing, the other events you've laid down here are too incredible on their own and quite frankly...
The man takes the fossilized bone fragments.
What is it you find incredible?
Well, where would you like me to start?
So many of the events described in your report defy belief.
Antarctica is a long way from Dallas, Agent Scully. I can't...
Aboard the flatbed car of a freight train, a man applies decals to a white tanker trailer.
Bees and corn crops do not quite fall under the rubric of domestic terrorism.
No, they don't.
The decals read,
most
Nature's Best Corn Oil. Elsewhere, men dressed in black military fatigues torch acres of corn stalks.
I realize the ordeal you've endured has clearly affected you. Though the holes in your account leave this panel with little choice but to delete these references to our final report to the Justice Department, until which time hard evidence becomes available that would give us cause to pursue such an investigation.
Agent Scully stares intensely at the chairwoman, then stands and approaches her. Skinner watches as Scully sets a small glass vial on the polished tabletop. The chairwoman studies it. A single honeybee sits on the bottom, its limbs crumpled and lifeless.
I don't believe the FBI currently has an investigative unit qualified to pursue the evidence in hand.
Scully turns her back to the committee and strides toward the door. As she leaves, Skinner levels a stern gaze on the chairwoman, who returns his look. Later, by a reflecting pool, Mulder sits on a park bench, reading a newspaper. A small headline reads, "Fatal hantavirus outbreak in northern Texas contained." Mulder notices Scully approaching. He folds the paper and offers it to her. Scully takes it. Red windburns speckle her cheeks and brow.
There's an interesting work of fiction on page 24. Mysteriously, our names have been omitted. They're burying this thing, Scully. They're just gonna dig a new hole and cover it up.
I told OPR everything I know. What I experienced, the virus, how it spread by the bees from pollen and transgenic crops.
You're wasting your time, Scully. They'll never believe you. Not unless your story can be programmed, categorized, or easily referenced.
Well, then we'll go over their heads.
No, no. How many times have we been here before, Scully? Right here, so close to the truth. And now we've seen and what we know to be right back at the beginning with nothing.
This is different, Mulder.
No, it isn't. You were right to want to quit. You're right to want to leave me. You should get as far away from me as you can. I'm not going to watch you die, Scully, because of some hollow personal cause of mine. Go be a doctor. Go be a doctor while you still can.
I can't. I won't. Mulder, I'll be there, but my work is here with you now. Look, that virus that I was exposed to, whatever it is, it has a cure. You held it in your hand. How many other lives can we save? Look.
She takes his hand.
If I quit now, they win.
Her soft gaze meets his. The corner of Mulder's mouth curls in a hint of a smile, and they stride off. Now, in a desert, a helicopter's shadow warps as it skims over smooth dunes. The chopper's black hull gleams in the golden sunlight. Words type out on screen, "Foam Tatooine, Tunisia." Later, the shoes of two men plod through the sand beside a cornfield. One pair, made of dusty black leather, is worn by the cigarette-smoking man.
Commander! We had the Hawass Alik! Yes, Commander!
Struggled steps from the cornfield and faces the smoking man.
You look hot and miserable. Why have you traveled all this way?
We have business to discuss.
You have regular channels.
This involves Mulder.
His name. Again and again.
He's seen more than he should.
What has he seen? Of the whole, he has seen but pieces.
He's determined now. Reinvested.
He's but one man. One man alone cannot fight the future.
Yesterday, I received this.
He hand struggled a telegram. Struggled's beady blue eyes look up. He lets the paper drop from his hand and strides off. On the ground, the telegram reads, "X-Files reopened. Stop. Please advise. Stop." The smoking man exhales a tired puff and walks away. Under the pale blue sky, rows of corn stretch to a horizon of high dunes. Five pairs of large white domes sit nestled in the cornfields. fade to black. This film has been described by Descriptive Video Service, a division of the Media Access Group at WGBH, with funding by the U.S. Department of Education. Described by Matthew Lane. Read by Miles Neff. For more about DVS, call 1-800-333-1203 or visit our website at dvs.wgbh.org. Credits. Presented by 20th Century Fox. A 1013 production. Music by Mark Snow. Special makeup effects by Alec Gillis and Tom Woodruff Jr. Co-producer, Frank Spotnitz. Film editor, Stephen Mark. Production designer, Christopher Novak. Director of photography, Ward Russell. Executive producer, Latta Ryan. Produced by Chris Carter and Daniel Sackheim. Screenplay by Chris Carter. Story by Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz. Directed by Rob Bowman. Cast: David Duchovny as Agent Fox Mulder. Gillian Anderson as Agent Dana Scully. John Neville as the well-manicured man. William B. Davis as the cigarette-smoking man. Martin Landau as Kurzweil. Mitch Pileggi as Assistant Director Walter Skinner. Jeffrey DeMunn as Braunschweig. Blythe Danner as Cassidy. Terry O'Quinn as Michaud. Armin Mueller-Stahl as Struggled. Lucas Black as Stevie. Christopher Fennell as Second Boy. Cody Newton as Third Boy. Blake Stokes as Fourth Boy. Dean Haglund as Langley, the Lone Gunman. Bruce Harwood as Byers, the Lone Gunman. Tom Braidwood as Frohike, the Lone Gunman. Don S. Williams as Group Elder. George Murdoch as Second Elder. Michael Seamus Wiles as Black-Haired Man. Craig Davis as Primitive Number 1. Carrick O'Quinn as Primitive Number 2. Tom Woodruff Jr. as Creature Number 1. Gregory B. Ballora as Creature Number 2. T.W. King as FBI Agent on Roof. Louise Beckford as FBI Agent. Steve Rankin as Field Agent. Gary Grubbs as Fire Captain Coolis. Stephen M. Gagnon as Last Agent Out. Lawrence Joshua as DC Cop. Glendon Rich as DC Cop Number 2. Gunther Jensen as Security Guard. Scott Smith as Technician. Ian Ruskin as Well-Manicured Man's Valet. Paul Welterlin as Control Room Operator. Joel Trawick as Young Naval Guard. Milton Johns as British Valet. Paul Twerpe as First Paramedic. Michael A. Kravick as Second Paramedic. Larry Rippenkroger as Town Car Driver. Josh McLaughlin as Buzz Miho. Randy Hall as Windbreaker Agent. T.C. Badalato as Fireman. Amin Zari as Tunisian. David W. Paris as Aerial Coordinator, Pilot. Original soundtrack available on Elektra Records. Read the book by Harper Prism.